This is a Defocus Media production. What's up, everyone? It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover.
And I'm Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, resident optometry nerd.
And welcome to Defocus Media, optometry's number one podcast, where we discuss the hottest topics, latest technology, eyewear, practice management, and more. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Defocus Media Podcast. I'm Jennifer Lyerly, and I'm here with Daryl Glover, obviously.
Yeah, what's up, everyone? It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover. Jen, how are you doing today?
Good. I think we're all kind of exhausted, right? We've been seeing patients today, and eye care is busier than ever. And I know, Daryl, you were just working on some charts like a few seconds before we came on the show.
Yeah. You know, and it's a great problem to have. You know, when patients want to come in and see you, and they want to invite all their friends and family to see you as well, I'm not going to ever run away from that. I'm going to make sure I take good care of those patients and make sure I have the solutions to allow them to live their best life. So, you know, I'm all about it, Jen.
Well, one thing that I think we've all seen an increased demand for, not just in the past year, but over the last several years, is dry eye care. And dry eye is definitely something that can both inspire you as a doctor and frustrate you to no end, because everybody's a little bit different in their spectrum of symptoms and presentation and how they respond to the available treatments. But what's really great is the treatments continue to evolve and new treatments are continuing to get FDA approval. So we brought an expert on the show to try to talk to us about managing dry eye in the modern era. Please welcome Dr. Derek Cunningham.
Hello, everybody.
Dr. Cunningham, would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself and your background in optometry?
Sure. Before I was in my current setting, I was the director of ophthalmology at Texas Tech School of Medicine. And I did that for about 6 years. And then when I finally found someone to be the dean, I got to leave. And so now I'm in a referral center. And it's funny you bring up dry eye. It's a really interesting topic in that I never liked dry eye and I never wanted any part of it. So for us, what it was is I came to a center that was basically LASIK and presbyopia correcting IOLs. And we quickly realized about 12 years ago, me and my partner, Stephen Dell, that the number one factor that was affecting success of patients was dry eye symptoms. And so we quickly invested in every technology that was available, whether it was domestic or international, whether it was FDA approved or not. And we brought everything in. And if we couldn't bring it in, you know, under normal pretenses, we did studies with it. And we quickly became kind of a hub for dry research in the United States just by accident, because we were trying to increase our other business. And that's what led to a lot of these technologies. Like, you know, when we created the FDA study for IPL, it was something that was born out of necessity. It wasn't that we went looking for it.
I think a lot of us are similar to you, right? We kind of stumbled into dry eye, not because we thought we were interested in it, but we found it was vital to the success of what we were doing. I know I was doing contact lenses and there was no way to get that person seeing great if they had a tear film that wasn't functional. And Daryl, I know you do a lot of refractive care, but your glasses aren't going to look great if they're looking through a terrible ocular surface.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as eye care professionals and us as great eye care professionals, you really have to make the connection. If you don't have a healthy tear film, you're not going to be able to see well. And at the end of the day, Jen, you and I both know we can find that retinal hole. We can find that macular detachment. But if those glasses aren't right, the patients aren't going to be happy. So, you know, the tear film is one piece of the pie that we definitely need to make sure is always on point. And I know you do that, Jen. I've seen you do that. And it's something that all of us as eye care professionals should really take seriously.
I'm just curious, obviously you guys are doing a lot of laser vision and refractive surgery. What percentage of those people do you feel like are dry sufferers?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I've never had someone come in for LASIK and say, I love contacts, can I have LASIK? All right, so 100% of contact lens patients have dry eye. The reason why they're having LASIK is they can't stand their contact lenses, which is contact lens intolerance. And so, you know, by the letter of the law, those are contraindicated patients for LASIK, because you're not supposed to be LASIK on dry eye patients, right? So that puts us in a little predicament. If you look at the FACO study, 87% of all cataract patients in the United States have dry eye, level 2 ITF dry eye, which is not mild dry eye. You know, we helped build a study to kind of show that. And it was interesting that when you take these metrics together and you understand that the stakes are even higher when we start doing something called a refractive lens exchange. That means I'm taking people that see 20/20 with glasses and contacts, and I'm doing surgery, and there's only one way they can go. And that's not a good way a lot of times when it comes to final visual acuity. But you have to understand that a center like ours, 50% of all surgeries we did last year were refractive lens exchanges. That's how popular this is. These are 40 and 50 year olds who just don't want to wear glasses.
That is incredible. I cannot believe that the surgery rate was that high for you guys. Wow.
Yeah. Well, so in our center, we're a little bit of a destination center. So we are a little bit out of the norm. 98% of all of our patients that have cataract surgery have presbyopia correcting lenses. So to us, it's a norm. But even the 40 and 50 year old, when they come in, you got to think their dry eye that may be inconsequential on day-to-day practice kind of ideas. I'm now taking this person and I'm going to put a diffractive optic in their eye that's going to split light. So if they have any amount of dry eye, it's going to be really, really obvious. Plus, they're not a 90-year-old that's watching Murder, She Wrote and reading, you know, books all night. They're on the go and they're doing a lot of active stuff. So they're going to notice any deterioration in their vision. And it was dry eye that was killing us in the beginning. And it's still, I lecture to surgeons all day long that, you know, the number one thing that's going to affect their surgical results is dry eye. For years, these presbyopia correcting lenses got a bad name because people thought they were inconsistent or variable. I promise you, those things do exactly what they're supposed to do 100% of the time. The only problem ever is patient selection. And that's what we struggle with educating a lot of our, you know, surgical colleagues as well as you know, our primary care docs too.
All right, let's talk about how you're finding this dry eye, because I know the patients are coming into you. They're wanting to get this refractive surgery done, and they do not say, like, I have all this dry eye that's bothering me. So you have to find it on non-complaining people. What are your high hit rate tests?
Yeah. So, well, one of the things you have to understand too is contact lenses create corneal neuropathy. So they shield you away from the dry eye that you have. So if you're going to take people out of contacts and do surgery, those nerves are going to start working again, whether you did surgery or not, and they're going to have some amount of dryness return. And then compound that with we're doing the surgery. Now we're creating the dryness in their mind. And so we make every one of our surgical patients go through our dry eye clinic. Now we also have a well-established dry eye clinic that just sees referrals only from optometrists and ophthalmologists. And we do about 30 patient encounters a day just in our dry eye clinic. And that is where we really started to get creative with ways of addressing the root cause, because yeah, we can steroid people all we want. Yeah, we can, you know, put people on drops that they may or may not use and put them on lots of therapies. But the genesis of dry eye is trying to figure out why they got to that place in the first place. What's the pathophysiological problem that we need to address, and how can we get some type of evolution, revolution back to active gland status? And then really serve the patient better over their lifetime and maintain their good vision for the rest of their life and not just put a Band-Aid on what the problem is.
So I'm curious. I'd love for you to walk us through the process of what it looks like when someone goes to that dry eye clinic. Because with you having such a high percentage of these premium IOLs, you must be doing something that maybe we're not doing. Or maybe you're doing it and you're just doing it better. So I'm curious to know what that process looks like.
So, for instance, if someone comes into our dry eye clinic, they've failed community therapy with one of our doctors. So it's a different stage. Now, if they're coming in for cataract or LASIK surgery, they have to go through a dry eye, separate dry eye evaluation. This does two really important things. It makes the patient aware of their condition, that this is not a curable condition. This is something we're going to manage for the rest of their life. And number two, we're very blunt. We are going to induce insult on their corneal tissue. This is going to make things worse. And what we have to do is proactively manage it long term. And so they get, when they come into the dry eye clinic, the most important tool I ever look at first and foremost as a surgery center is basically a topography. That tells me what kind of chronicity they've had in their dry eye. That tells me the type and value of their tear film. That's more important than any of the fancy tools we have. My biography has obviously been a big step in letting people understand what they're seeing, you know, what their state is. And you show a blown up picture of anyone's eye to them, and you blow it up enough, it looks gross and it scares them. It doesn't matter if it's healthy or not. So, you know, when people see glands dying out, they flip the switch a little bit. And we have subtle things that we play to people's concerns as well. You know, if I see a female patient and I'll say that, you know, you have a little blepharitis and this is going to cause some eyelid thickening. It causes your eyelids to get a little red. They can notch and you can lose eyelashes. We just don't want that. And, you know, that will spur them on. We have a aesthetics practice as well. So we get to play with a lot of that side. And it's really in the aesthetics world where we found the IPL. It was a lot of our aesthetics patients were claiming that their dry eye felt better after IPLs. And there were some doctors in the country that were messing around with the IPL and dry eye at this time. This is probably, gosh, over 10 years ago. So what we did is we were just, I guess, the first clinic that addressed this to the FDA and said, listen, we're going to design a study to show that IPL has some type of benefit on dry eye. And we didn't know if it was going to be positive or not because we were doing this anecdotally. You know, some of our colleagues said, yeah, you drive IPL for dry eye, but no one had ever shown or proved anything. So we developed a large scale study with Lumenis and, you know, we went into it to see what we could find.
This is, so obviously I've never done an FDA clinical study, but the fact that you as a clinic can put together and propose, I mean, it's truly incredible. I'm sure there was a ton of paperwork and hurdles to make that happen.
Well, you're never alone in these things. So obviously you need substantial financial support, and that's where industry always comes in. So you're going to find a financial partner. Now, you know, Lumenis was a company at the time. They were virgin in the United States. They really didn't have any units placed. And they had they were kind of the Cadillac of IPLs at the time in the aesthetics world. And so we approached them and they were very keen to get something going. They had already some conceptual ideas of dry in the United States. They just weren't really doing anything with it. And so this had never been done before, not on a large scale study basis. So I designed studies simply based on aesthetic protocols. I went with what really worked well in the aesthetics world that we were doing. And I thought that would be the best concept for dry eye because there was no concept of proof here. There was no proof that this actually worked.
All right, let's talk about finding the right candidate because most of us listening to the show probably don't have IPL in our practices yet. Yeah. But we probably have a lot of patients that would benefit from it, but we don't know who they are at the moment. So,
well, I'll put it to you this way. Everyone in the world could benefit from an IPL. No one's as pretty as they think they are. But really what the concept comes down to is IPL basically does this. It's short wavelength blue light that activates what's called photophores in your skin. And that's hemoglobin and that's pigment, melanin, and that's water. And so it will cauterize those three things. And when it does that, it has a secondary effect. It can reduce wrinkles. But namely in the aesthetics world, what they use it for is making your skin more porcelain-like. So it gets rid of age spots, freckles, sunspots, sun damage. You know, it really unifies your kind of face. And actually, it was years ago that we weren't even capable to do it on very dark skin types, East Asian or even African American. But there are settings even available for that now. The problem is that the darker your skin as a patient, the less energy we use because we can burn skin. The whiter your skin, the more energy we need to use to affect skin. But when we do this, we were doing it on the pretense that we wanted to affect the vascular blood supply to the eyes because that seemed to be what was working. Now, there's secondary and tertiary effects that we think work. We're just not sure. But really what happened initially, which was confusing for us, is we were treating these dry eye patients with four treatments, which is what we worked in the aesthetics world. And they were coming back after a year. And I was like, how was your dry eye? And they're like, I don't care about my dry eye anymore. Just do this. You know, so the aesthetics world is so powerful. You have to take it with a grain of salt because they see that benefit every day. They're motivated every day. I tell people they have glaucoma. I kind of believe you. I'm not going to use the drops though, unless it's the lash growth drops that you give me. So, you know, it's kind of one of these things that when it comes to IPL, clearly the lighter the skin, the better. But keep in mind, in recent studies, we found that 70% of all Caucasians, which includes Hispanics and Asians genealogically, have telangiectasia on their lid margin, which means they have rosacea. These are clear candidates for IPL. So theoretically, 70% of the population would benefit from an IPL. 100% would benefit from an aesthetic side, but we think in dry eye that not absolutely everyone would benefit from an IPL. So I don't want to sound like it's a kind of cure all, but realistically, if you're starting to talk about people who have inflamed lid margins, any amount of telangiectasia, any amount of redness in their face there. And remember, the majority of dry eye now we think is a skin disease. It's no longer kind of an eye disease. So going after the root culprit and the root cause is kind of really what we're trying to do. So as far as a key candidate, it's really almost anybody, but certainly it's a skew towards the people that can have the telangiectasia or the thickening of the lid margin.
Now, I know you said it's for everyone, but who is the ideal or the patient that you would say there's no way in hell that we're going to do this on this patient? You know, whether we're talking about age, whether it's type of personality. Yeah. I mean, there's always someone out there, you're like, oh no, we're going to have to.
I'll put you this way. As tough as dudes think they are, they're not, because you can stick a fork in a woman's eye. If it makes her look better, she'll say it don't hurt. I've had men like scream at the top of their lungs, get up and leave the chair, and including one ER physician who just lost his mind. He said we were a criminal for what we were doing and how could we do this? This is an ER physician. So, you know, one of the things that you have to remember is realistic expectations. The laser, the light that we use is very superficial. It doesn't go deep enough to treat crazy. So if you have someone coming in that has unrealistic expectations, they're too worried about a cosmetic benefit, they're better off getting treated at a spa. They don't need to be in your practice. If you have people that reasonably understand that they want their dry eye to get better and they like the idea of a cosmetic side effect, that's an ideal patient. The second thing is, if you have people that come in that have really bad melasma, that can be a contraindication. Some inflammatory skin conditions, some bad lupus, those kind of things, those can be a contraindication. And realistically, you know, the people that have really uncontrolled, I guess, dermatological diseases is some of the ones you want to stay away from. Otherwise, I think of IPL as something like maintenance. It's a stimulation of the gland and it gets rid of the telangiectasia, which is the leaking blood vessels that are causing the problem. It doesn't evacuate the glands uniquely. You can evacuate them afterwards with forceps, or in a perfect world, if money was no object, I would like to do something like a tear care beforehand, evacuate the glands, and then do 4 IPLs as maintenance therapy over the next couple months. That would be a great idea for most patients that have significant lid disease.
Gotcha. And let me ask you this. Is there a certain age that you cap it off that you don't see?
No, you know, the older the better, to be honest with you. It's the opposite. It's the younger. You know, I get a lot of 20-year-old women coming in that want either Botox or IPL. And I look at this like perfect skin.
Hold on, Derek. 20-year-old women coming in asking for Botox?
Yeah, this is very common, Daryl. Yeah, if you've been on Instagram, you know that.
Allergan released a study several years ago to show that if you preventatively do Botox when you're young, that you can retard the aging effects like for 40 years. And they released this study of all these people that got free Botox starting in their early 20s, and they got it for like 25 years. Well, guess what? They don't have a wrinkle on their face. They look pristine. And of course, it's in Allergan's best interest to say, this is what y'all should do. Mm-hmm. So it's still hard for me when I got a 20-year-old coming in and say, I want Botox, for me to say, oh, okay, we'll do it, when I have nowhere, you know, you got no wrinkles to go after. But it's the same thing with IPL. They'll come in because they know they want some preventative therapy. But when you have really, really kind of nice young skin, it's not going to give you any benefit. It really won't. You have to wait till the damage happens. And remember, this is what the aesthetics side has taught me, that the sun is the devil in every way for everybody. And so as much as we harp, you know, back in the day, stay away from the sun, but it's so important now. And the damage that you get from the sun when you're young and you don't care catches up with you when you're older. And right. That's the whole problem with a lot of this stuff. And it includes dry eye.
For sure. So as for the dry patients that are getting IPL done, on average, when do they start noticing maybe a difference in how they're feeling and their clinical signs of dryness? Does it take the full course of 4 treatments?
No, you know, in the clinical study, it became statistically significant after the 3rd treatment. Now, keep in mind, this was a very early attempt at understanding it. Since then, there's been a multitude of good studies that have come out that have really refined what we were trying to do. And there's a lot of ones that were done in Asia. There's some that were done in Europe. But really, the concept is this. Our study, we did 4 treatments separated by 3 to 4 weeks. And the treatment was really kind of superficial and just based on vasculature, because I didn't have anything smaller that I could go after, you know, the eyelids or anything like that with. And so in that study, yes, after 3 weeks, we were statistically significant with most patients. Yeah, you get one person that says it's great after 1 treatment. Yeah, you get some that say they didn't feel a difference after 4 treatments. But the probably the biggest thing that was a surprise surprise is we saw numbers like we've never seen in an FDA study for dry eye at the conclusion when it came to a patient, basically index scores for how the comfort felt, as well as tear breakup time as well.
Great.
So those were things that we did not have any, we had no idea that they would be that high. Now, we did not do a longitudinal study afterwards. So we didn't really, we still don't know truly how long these effects last. Remember, your body is going to go back to its natural resting spot no matter what we do. So eventually you will return to your resting spot, which you were beforehand. That's what your body does. So I tend to think with the people that we've treated over the last decade that symptoms tend to return with the cosmetic returns. So when people start getting the age spots back, when they start getting the freckles back, when they start kind of developing that stuff back, it seems like that's when the symptoms come back. And that's a little bit different for everyone. But, you know, maybe 6 months for some, a year for most, if we're lucky.
Got it.
So it sounds
a full rest of your life cure to get the four sessions. And then there's
well, the maintenance is not as bad. When you do the maintenance, you don't necessarily do four treatments again. When we do the maintenance, a lot of times we're just doing one treatment a year, maybe two.
Oh, okay.
That's not bad. That's not bad. And I'm curious, what's the price point on something like this?
Well, you know, it varies, obviously. You know, with us, we're roughly, for all four treatments, we do offer just the eyes and not the face. The problem is, and you have to be very upfront with people, and the dudes will tend to do this, not the women, is that you can significantly change their skin tone in the area you treat. And so you can literally give someone nice, smooth, unique skin here, but then the rest of their face looks gnarly. And that was a problem during the FDA study. We actually lost some people in the FDA study because they started to notice this was looking good. And they're like, no, you're going to do this. And I'm like, no, I can't. They're like, I'll pay for it. I'm out of the study. Do this. So, you know, that's one issue. So we will offer just the eyes. And that's, I would say that's probably about, you know, $1,500 for all four treatments. And then if we include the face, because it's not much more when we're there anyway, and that you're probably looking at about $2,000 for the four treatments. And that's kind of how we break it down. And then obviously we just fraction those for any of the touch-ups that we do down the road.
Have you found that in your patient's kind of treatment path, is this typically something that, okay, you're on Xiidra, you're on Restasis, we've tried pump the plug, is this more of an in-stage treatment that you find your patients are doing? Or do people sometimes jump to this first instead of going through these other modalities?
You know, you're absolutely right. This is how we all think about new treatments. We use them at end stage, which is unfair because you're using no disease responds well in end stage and you're not going to have a great response. We actually found, just like everything else, like all the treatments you've mentioned, the earlier you use them in the disease progression, the more beneficial and the better they work. So when we started doing IPL a lot earlier, and it was easy to do in this case because of the cosmetic benefit, it was easy to start pushing it earlier on dry eye patients. We had a much better response. You're not going to get blood from a rock. So if someone has really advanced disease and hardly any meibomian glands, you're not going to get much. Now, keep in mind, if we do mibography and they have no meibomian glands, Lipoflow and tear care just are not an option. But IPL still is, because there is a pro-growth hormone that can be stimulated through this on some of the other glands in the eye. Plus, simply getting rid of telangiectasia will decrease the inflammatory cascade in the eyelid itself. So there is a benefit, but I'm very clear with people. If they have no meibomian glands whatsoever, I'll say, listen, nothing is going to work well for you. Nothing. But the best option we have is the IPL. Now, if we go back a little bit earlier and kind of when are we going to treat them? Yeah, in a perfect world, I would love everyone to be on kind of like a Xiidra or anything like that. But people just don't like using chronic drops, you know, and they fall out of favor. And 80% of all scripts of Xiidra, Sequa, and Restasis are not refilled after 4 months. And so everyone thinks, well, that's not my clinic. Well, I promise you it is. It's everybody's clinic. But, you know, I tell people that of the diligent patients we had, about 20% of them feel like they can discontinue their chronic therapy after IPL, which doesn't seem like a stellar number, but remember, any incremental increase in dry eye is a huge deal to prove, because dry eye is incredibly resilient. It's an inflammatory disease that comes from your body. And so 20% is good. And like I said, it's like nothing we've ever had in eye care, because you have this cosmetic benefit on the back. So I don't know, have you guys, either of you ever had IPL?
No,
it is on my to-do list.
All right. I probably, I saw, I'll tell you this. I had it once. I do it all day long. I had it once. I'm good. You know, I'll let my skin get old and nasty. So yeah. I don't need to do that again, because it's like someone taking a rubber band and snapping it on your face over and over again. The crazy thing is, the women are just like, it's fine.
Got no problem. My mom just had it done a couple weeks ago. She was like, I loved it.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. Now, one thing to keep in mind, because there are a lot of aesthetics places that do dry eye, try to do dry eye that aren't eye doctors. In the general plastics world and the general aesthetics world, we don't ever train them and let them go near the eye orbit as well. So they're not going to get the eye benefit like you would if you went to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, number one, because you're not going to get uniquely trained on that protocol. The second thing is, there is a general rule with IPL that if it doesn't hurt, it didn't work. And I promise you that's true. And there's an old French saying that translates to basically beauty is painful. Mm-hmm. So if people are having IPLs, they're like, yeah, I get IPLs all the time. I don't feel it at all. They're not getting an efficacious IPL. It has to hurt in order to work, because you have to actually affect the cells by cauterizing them.
Right. That makes sense. All right, let's talk barrier to entry, because I think a lot of doctors are very interested in adding Optilite to their practice, but you can't just add the device without all the practice management that goes behind it. So if you were going to add IPL to your practice, what supplemental technology do you feel like is really essential to that success?
You know, I think probably the biggest thing, obviously, for us, and this, the price point on this is going to come down dramatically in the next several years, is MyBiography. And that's a pivotal thing for showing patients. Y'all have most of the data you need already. If you have a slit lamp camera or an iPhone that you can put on a slit lamp and show people their lid margins up close, you show people the telangiectasia, you show women the trichiasis, the subtle loss of lashes in the regions, you know, that's a massive, massive help in people understanding their disease state. So that's the biggest one. And the second one is, I think if you have a relatively busy practice, you're going to have to need to invest in a technician that can help you with this and more so do it for you. You know, it's funny, I go to a lot of these academic meetings and people are still talking about doing the IPLs themselves and stuff like that. I've never really done them much myself, like maybe on the VIP patients, but we're so busy. We have really, really well-trained technicians that do them. The doctor will skin type. The only problem, the only time you can really get in trouble with IPL is if you use too much energy. So we make the doctor do the Fitzpatrick skin type. A lot of times we'll make the doctor maybe do the first treatment. But after that, you're talking about affecting practice revenue too much, because this is an independent procedure that can be booked on a separate time. Patient comes in on the launch hour, you know, they get gelled up, they get a quick IPL done, and they're out the door. So you need a dedicated space in your office, number one, to do enough volume to make this worthwhile. Number two, you need to have a technician that is very comfortable doing this. And they have excellent people that can train, you know, your technician for you. And then I think the last thing is, yeah, you'd have to understand that you would have to be able to start having these conversations with patients that historically have been very, very comfortable, uncomfortable for not only optometrists, but more specifically male optometrists. And I don't know if I'm being sexist here, but, you know, Daryl, back me up, partner here. I used to be so uncomfortable talking about aesthetics with women. I would just not say stuff. Women would come in with like god awful, like just terrible eyelashes and makeup, and I'd just be so scared to say something. Now, a woman comes in with bad makeup, I put her on blast right away. You know, I'll be like, girl, the lights go out this morning. What happened? You know, we got to fix this. You know, and so the crazy thing is, they really appreciate it after a while. You would be amazed at how much patients want their doctors to talk about aesthetics and how they look, and especially. They want that. You know, the leading expert every day in the United States on eye makeup is whatever Kardashian posted last. And that's that's not the way that this needs to go. And like I said, patients are hungry for their doctors to reach out and talk to them a little bit about the aesthetic side of thing, the cosmetic side of thing, especially if it affects how their eyes feel, whether they're using eye makeup, stuff like that. So, you know, that's probably the biggest barrier too, is understanding that you're going to have to get comfortable, and it's not hard, but there's plenty of resources of you and your staff being able to talk about aesthetics. And keep in mind, the aesthetics market in the United States, the facial aesthetics market in the United States is like 100 times bigger than the eye market.
Yep.
Yeah, a lot of opportunity. And I do feel you in regards to that conversation. In the early stages, I was like, man, I don't know what the hell to say to this person. This is crazy. But as Jen and I started doing more interviews and talking ocular aesthetics, I started to get a little more comfortable. So now when they come in that exam room, and especially when they have those long lashes, you know, I can jump right into the mix and talk the talk with them. And they're looking at me like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
No one's ever told me that. And not even, you know, their previous optometrist was a male or female, but they like that someone is truly having that conversation and that dialogue. And, you know, they love to continue to build off of that. Now, I still got a long ways to go. But, you know, I'm in the early stages and I feel more comfortable having that conversation. Because when you think about it, it's a male sitting in front of you. They're telling you about makeup, what you should do, how to treat that. It's kind of like, I just had a lady last time that was my optometrist and she didn't mention that. So do you really know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
But it's that confidence. It's the data. It's the statistics. It's, you know, being around folks that understand this and starting to understand how they communicate. And that really can help elevate your practice in that communication with the patient that's in front of you.
Yeah,
I think, you know, as a female, maybe it's slightly more natural, but there's still a lot of hurdles to these conversations. Earlier today, I had a patient with ocular rosacea whose complaint to me was chronic styes, and she doesn't wear eye makeup because it irritates her. And I told her, I was like, oh, so when I look at your eyes, I can see all the redness and the broken blood vessels. It's classic for the ocular rosacea, which I can see the same facial redness here. And that's the culprit for everything. And she, like, immediately, like, because people sometimes have a bad reaction to their eye doctor telling them they have rosacea because they don't think that's my place to be diagnosing it. So all of us run into these kind of situations. And it's very, very important, like you said, to lean on the photography, to lean on the imaging and explain, see this redness here? That's that. Instead of leaning on the word rosacea, which can sometimes set people on the defensive right away.
Yeah. And you know, when it comes to these patients, I actually feel very confident and comfortable now. The patients that I have the problems with convincing are more of your, you know, between 50 and 70 year old males. Those guys don't want to have anything to do with any kind of treatment. Oh, my eyes. Okay. I don't have anything going on. What are you talking about? Just give me my glasses. Let me go. And, you know, you try to have that conversation and that dialogue with them, but they're not trying to have any part of that. I would love to get some advice from you, Derek. I mean, what kind of conversation are you having with those guys? And are you experiencing the same thing or not?
Yes and no. I think historically that was our biggest barrier group. But, you know, it's funny that when we were able to address these symptoms and we're able to address these in a non-confrontational way, it's accepted a lot better. So, you know, a lot of times with the males, basically, perfect example. Recently, when Upneek, the drop that came out that raises your eyelid and makes your eye white.
Yeah.
So when that came out, we just assumed it was going to be dominated by the female market. And we really weren't offering it to a lot of males. And soon we found out that, you know, we were getting all these requests from the husbands of all the women that we were giving this to. And it's because the wives were on the men to use it. And then the men were actually using it on a higher frequency than the women were. The women were using it for special occasions. Dudes were using it on a daily basis. And like I said, so the younger generation is clearly flipped over to be much more aesthetically aware. There's no doubt about that. But again, that's like your 30 to 50 year olds. Your 50 to 70 year olds are still relatively resilient. I lean on their wives a lot or their spouses a lot because they don't want to look at that nasty face.
You know, don't get me wrong, that's on your face.
Yeah, that's right. So that's one. And the second thing I'll spend a lot of time talking about is I'll say, listen, man, you know, what it does is the natural aging process with dryness and inflammation in your eye, it lowers your eyelid. And then it starts to create thick pink eyelids. And then you start to lose lashes and they're not just there for good looks. They're there to protect your eye. And right. So this is a functional issue with you. And we got to address this. And really what they want is they want some type of solution that's either turnkey or that they don't have to do a lot of themselves. And so that's where we're able to leverage us and just say, listen, I can prescribe you drops where you don't have to use those every day of the rest of your life, you know, or, you know, we have these other therapies that can restore the way that the glands are supposed to work in the first place. And that tends to be much more accepted, but there is no doubt. I'm not going to play like this as even, you know, a contest. The 80% of the IPLs we're doing are on women. And like I said, but everyone gets a benefit.
I think we all face the same hurdles, and Daryl, you know, we all have a patient with bloodshot red eyes in the chair, and you're like, oh, have you noticed you have some redness? And like, nah, I haven't noticed anything. I still like, okay, we'll talk about this today.
The best part was when we first had oculoplastic specialists we were working with, we had this one, she was awesome. She'd walk in the room and she'd go to a patient, she'd be like, are you all right with what's going on right there? And she just put her face. Yeah, I was like, oh my God, I could never say that to a patient. You got out of your mind. But then these patients would be like, oh my God, thank you for asking, blah, blah, blah. And they'd go like crazy. So I think a more tactful way you'll see a lot of oculoplastic specialists do it is they'll walk in and they'll give the patient a mirror. They'll say, I want you to look in the mirror. Tell me what you like and what you don't like. That's a creative way of doing it. So a lot of them patients are picking what they notice and what they don't notice and what they want addressed. And that's a very creative way for a lot of the oculoplastics people to do this. I do the same thing. And now I say, you know, when it comes to when you're looking at your eyes in the mirror, what do you like about your eyes and what do you wish you could change a little bit? And that helps with some of the patients. With the other patients, I'll just say, listen, you know, it's very important to understand eye redness is a signal that you're either tired, fatigued, or diseased. And so if you're carrying eye redness around a lot, it affects how people interact with you. And so, you know, this is what we want to do is we want to try to address the redness and get rid of it. So you don't have to use Visine 4 or 5 times a day. And the crazy thing about eye care is we vilify Visine forever. Visine is great. It's awesome. It's just people are treating glaucoma with Visine. They're treating retinal detachments with Visine. You know, they're treating every disease, you know, with Visine, and it's just masking the problem. Mm-hmm. People want white eyes and we need to understand that and agree with patients. Just say, yes, Visine is great, but let's see if we can figure out a reason why you need the Visine and maybe you don't need it once we can treat it. So, you know, I don't slap people's hands for using Visine for sure.
Since we have such a great opportunity to pick your brain on some of these other practice management modalities, if you have patients in your clinic, which are clearly at rosacea at their core, but you do not yet have IPL or have a patient that's interested in that, do you have alternative treatments that you find not as effective clearly, but that do tend to help for the patient who's just not ready to do IPL yet, like a oral doxy or a Metrogel ointment or a...
Yeah, you know, we've never found any benefit with Metrogel. Doxy is still king. I tell you, I love that stuff if people can tolerate it. At 50 milligrams a day, which is the cheapest dose besides going to like the 20 milligrams more expensive dose, the 50 milligrams is well tolerated. It's not an antimicrobial dose, so it won't clean up the gut flora, but it's anti-inflammatory within the eyelid itself. So we do like doxy a lot. Sun exposure is a big thing. We also like mineral-based facial moisturizers. Yeah, so it's not going to affect the rosacea as much. There are some facial moisturizer companies that do make rosacea specific moisturizers as well.
Do you have a brand that you refer to your patients?
There's lots of them. It depends on cost and you know, how much they want. You know, most of them are physician specific, so you can only get them from a physician's office. There's one out of Dallas I really like because it's botanical. It's very mild and it's really not expensive. And we put it up against all the major lines in head-to-head studies that we did in our clinic. And it performed as good or almost as good as all of them at about a quarter of the price. It's called Revision. It's out of Dallas. The Lumiere and that line of eye creams, they're insanely expensive. They are good. They're very, very good. But, you know, you're talking about $200 to $300. A month for, you know, that type of treatment. That's not reasonable for most of our patients. It's really not. And if it is reasonable for those patients, please refer them to our clinic. But you know, it's kind of one of these things that the other thing too is with rosacea, you got to understand it's a trigger, right? It's a trigger that could be sun, stress, food related as well. So the dry eye is going to on its own go up and down regardless of what you do. And we got caught with this in early studies because we're treating people. And it just so happens one person we'd catch while their inflammation was going down and we put them on something and we thought it was the something that worked and it wasn't. Right. It was a natural cycle of inflammation. And you get caught in these like false positives all the time. So what we eventually did with rosacea patients is we said, listen, before we really buy into any treatment with you, we're going to watch you for a long time and try a whole bunch of different stuff. The hypochlorous acid is an absolute must. It is, I don't care which one you're using. It is a dead 100% must. It is all it is salt and vinegar. That's all hypochlorous acid is, buffered salt and vinegar. But it's antimicrobial and it's anti-inflammatory, especially for inflammatory skin. And so we've been using it on diabetics to help diabetic wounds heal faster for 40, 50 years. And so to do it on the eyelid is a no-brainer. And we use it on 100% of our bleph patients and almost 100% of our dry eye patients. And the one thing that I see a lot of misinformation on with hypochlorous acid is you have to leave it on the skin to get any benefit. And so we don't apply it with any kind of cotton swabs. We don't apply it with Q-tips because what you're doing is you're soaking up all the fluid as you come on. And you're not going to have a lasting benefit. In order for truly you to have a benefit, and this is really well known in the aesthetics world, you have to leave it on the skin. When you spray it on the eye, you got to let it air dry. So I have people use their finger instead of any type of applicator, spray it on the eyelash, use their finger, rub it in and let it air dry. It takes 10 seconds out the door. Because if they're using any kind of cotton applicator, it's just going to wipe up all the extra solution. They're not going to get the benefit.
So even if you don't see bleph or scurf or collarettes, like you need this cleaner.
Yeah, because 100% of our female staff use it. A lot of our male staff use it as well. And it just takes away a little of the redness in the morning that a lot of us get anyway. And because it's such a nice passive treatment, you know, hypochlorous acid is a byproduct of eosinophils in your body's own immune system. So it's a natural product that your body's exposed to every day, all the time on a cellular basis. And so you're not going to develop an allergy to it. You're not going to develop a resistance to it. It's not going to work for some people, but it pretty much works for everybody. And it helps remove a little debris. I'm not quite buying the idea that it does anything really for Demodex, even though they claim it does. Demodex is a very difficult thing to deal with. But, you know, as far as everything else, it's just a nice thing you keep in the bathroom. You do it after you shower, you do it before bed, quick squirt, you're good.
Awesome. I'm going to employ more hypochlorous acid in my clinic. I've been reserving it. Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your advice on our patient management discussion. I know a lot of people listening to the show are interested in adding IPL to their practice and going into these next steps. Do you have any advice on where people could learn more or learn more from your clinic if they had questions after the show?
Yeah, you know, we're pretty good about answering any kind of emails and stuff like that. You know, it was interesting. It was when IPL kind of first, we did the FDA study, you know, it was like, can this ophthalmology group reach out to you or this group? Or, you know, because initially they only marketed to ophthalmology. And people were kind of reserved about asking questions unless they knew us. And then the great thing about the optometry community is when we started, you know, when Lumenis started selling this to optometry, and you can go to Lumenis's website, domestic website, to get more information. They have dedicated trainers that will come out to your office and train you and your staff. You're not in this alone. They will help you with this kind of stuff. And we even have programs where we'll mentor people. You know, we'll have them come in and talk about stuff. I get people asking me all the time, should I buy an IPL? Should I get a lip flow? Should I get a tear care? Yes. But you don't have unlimited money. So, you know, they're not doing the same thing. I don't even think tear care and Lipiflow do the same thing. And so when it comes to what you're going to do, I think you have to understand you got to buy the technology that you can believe in most initially, number one. Number two, it has to be the most reasonable for your clinic. I have lots of people that have bought IPLs, but they just don't have the time or the space in their clinic for it. And so it ends up getting shoved in the corner and they don't use it. So, and you have to, I think, look at the numbers and buy it because it's going to be a benefit to your patients and it's not going to make you go broke. I wouldn't buy it because you're going to cash out and make $1 billion if that's what you're looking at it for. I promise you, if you buy it because it's going to help your patients and you at least have the overhead to make it work, that you will be insanely profitable with it. It's just the people that I've seen that buy it for a money generating device, it doesn't work, it seems. So it just goes back to kind of us inherently as doctors. So if we're not truly believing something's going to help, it's really going to be hard to sell it to our patients.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer, man. You put the patients first, the money will come. You never have to worry about the dollar always. Patient. At all. It follows you. It chases you. It hunts you down. You know what I'm saying?
It does. If you find something you love and you can believe in it and you can talk to patients about it, you can show that energy and your staff says, oh my gosh, yeah, my staff gets IPLs all the time. They kill it. They love it. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to sell in that case.
Well, awesome. Thank you again so very much. We learned a ton from you tonight.
My pleasure. Always fun talking to you.
Yeah, we got to get you back on the show, man. You know, any new innovation that comes out in dry eye, I think you might be our new go-to guy to be able to give us the real deal. Because I love the way that you convey the message, you keep it real, it's easy to digest, and it seems like you got hands-on experience. And I love that it seems like everything that you bring in your office, you run a study on, you have some type of pilot, you have the data, and that's the key thing. You're able to back up what you're talking about, and that's what people want to hear.
And like I said, it makes for some trouble sometimes, but the problem is, in a setting like ours, to be honest with you, when you're doing what we're doing, when we're doing 98% presbyopia correcting IOLs, when we're doing all these refractive lens exchanges, you have to be able to back up what you're saying with some type of legitimate type of discussion or defense. And then secondarily, people that kind of are coming to our clinic are like, listen, you better be the leading latest greatest in everything. If if this is what your rep is and this is how you're portrayed, we want the we don't want to hear that someone in New York has something better than you. We don't want to hear that someone in LA has something nicer or better. This is Austin. This is the genesis of technology now. We got to go and we got the med school now and stuff. So yeah.
Gotcha. You built the vision and you bought everything you need, and then the people who want that care come to you. So
I still don't like dry eye though. Yeah, I'm not gonna honest, I really don't. I don't want to be a part of it, but it's what it is.
byproduct of your success.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. Everyone, thank you for tuning in. Have a fantastic evening. It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Darryl Glover, your favorite opto nerd, Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, and the one and only Dr. Derek. Man, thanks again. Have a wonderful day.
Take care, guys.
Good night.
All right, colleagues, and it's a wrap. Thank you dearly for hanging out with the Defocus Media team. We hope truly something resonated with you. And if it did, be sure to give us 5 stars and make sure you follow us on all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, you named it. And our handle is at Defocus Media on all platforms. And until next time, be sure to keep it 2020 and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.